Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, are online courses the future of higher ed? We'll speak with the CEO of the nation's largest nonprofit provider of massive open online courses, or MOOCs.
But first, to Cuba, where the highest-level U.S. delegation to visit that communist island in 3 decades is in its second day of talks with Cuban officials, part of that effort to normalize relations between the longtime foes. Among other things, Cuba is demanding that it be removed from a U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. The U.S. wants Cuba to lift restrictions on American diplomats in Cuba, and it also wants assurances that Cubans will have unfettered access to a future U.S. embassy. And, of course, one of the biggest obstacles, immigration policy. NPR's Carrie Kahn is in Havana. And, Carrie, just what's been going on?
Well, this morning, both delegations arrived early this morning to a convention center outside of Havana. You can feel the history being made there. It was quite historical to see the both sides on this long, long conference table about, you know, more than a dozen on each side. These are the sticky talks. These are the ones about reestablishing diplomatic ties. So yeah. I'm sure we'll hear a lot more today on how that's going later in the afternoon when they brief reporters.
Well, the hope is to reestablish embassies, post ambassadors at each other's capitals in the coming months. But talk about immigration, which was discussed yesterday. And the current law is often colloquially referred to as wet foot, dry foot. Just tell us a little bit about that.
It's quite interesting because, you know, here we are all gathered. There's press from all over the world ready for these historic talks. And they sat down to talk about immigration policy, which they do periodically anyway. And the first thing you hear is we agree to disagree. So it was sort of this big buildup, and then it was just the same old thorny issues. The Cubans have great distaste for what is colloquially called wet foot, dry foot policy. And what that is if you are a Cuban coming to the United States and you make it onto the mainland, you after a year you can get residency. If you're caught at sea, you're returned to Cuba. And that's what we heard when we were briefed by the head of their delegation, Jose Josefina Vidal. The first thing she said was, this is what is driving, in our opinion, illegal immigration from the island. She also said that it's causing brain drain on the island because Cuba, as you probably know, sends a lot of doctors and professionals and technicians to other third world countries to help out. And they go legally to those countries, and then a lot of people defect and come into the United States.
This accusation of the U.S. causing a brain drain, this is the Cuban Medical Professional Parole Program. Tell us more about that. The Cubans say it encourages doctors to leave.
Right. They say that the entire policy of just the United States granting immediate political asylum and residency after 1 year to Cubans is causing a brain drain on the island. And most of it is from, they say, that doctors or professionals that go to third countries legally from Cuba then defect and head to the United States. And they say it's an incentive to pull their professionals and their intellects from the island. They just don't like the policy, and they say, if you really want to crack down on illegal immigration, why are you giving this preferred status to only one nation in the world? It's just, they think it's ridiculous, and they want an end to it. And the U.S. diplomat that came out said, we stand by our policy, and this is the way it's going to be. And so we agree to disagree. And that was the first day and opening of these historic talks.
Right.
And it was just sort of a scene setter of what's coming ahead.
Well, we still have to get through topics like political prisoners. The U.S. wants to deport thousands of Cubans who've been convicted of crimes in the U.S. Will Cuba accept them?
They did not address that specifically at all. That was a complaint that the U.S. Made and spoke about that they want to get resolved, and the Cubans did not address that. They wanted to express their distaste for this wet foot, dry foot policy that they say is driving illegal immigration out of Cuba.
Well, Carrie Kahn, there you are in Cuba. Have you had a chance to get the feeling of the country about these talks?
It's quite interesting. I was here just a month ago, and when both presidents announced the thawing of relations, and then again yesterday I went out and I was just talking to people actually queuing up a huge line to get ice cream. And so I had sort of a captive audience there. People are very well tuned in to what is going on. Everybody knew that the talks were here. They knew that the American delegation is. What seemed to me was that expectations are incredibly high. They want the embargo lifted. They want to be able to go visit visit relatives in Florida and in the United States. That's what everybody told me there. They just see it all as positive and very hopeful that this will open travel restrictions and that they can go and travel freely and visit relatives and start receiving goods from the U.S. and that bring more development to the nation. It was difficult to keep talking about the high expectations when you hear how high they are, when those issues are not even on the table today. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about very mundane details of reestablishing diplomatic ties, of how you would go about opening an embassy, like increasing the number of diplomats that could come to the islands, lifting travel restriction for the diplomats here, things like that. That's what the U.S. wants to talk about. Cuba has much bigger issues.
Well, hope the expectations aren't dashed. NPR's Carrie Kahn in Havana as talks there, historic talks, begin. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, as we heard in the State of the Union address on Tuesday, President Obama is putting a new focus on community colleges to try and improve education. The nonprofit company edX has the same goal, but is trying to make change online. As part of a new series we're starting today called The View from the Top, in which we'll be speaking with leaders of industry, of nonprofits, of governments, of small businesses and startups, of anything really. We're joined today by the head of edX, which is the nation's largest nonprofit provider of massive open online courses, or MOOCs. edX CEO Anant Agarwal joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
Well, explain, first of all, the goal of edX. What is it that you're trying to do?
We are trying to really revolutionize the world of education. Large numbers of people around the world do not have access to a quality education. And at the same time, education itself has not dramatically improved in quality or in efficiency in a long time. Our aim is to increase access to learning to people all over the world. We partner with some of the best universities in the world, such as MIT, Harvard, Georgetown, Tsinghua from China, and so on, but they offer courses on edX that learners can take for free no matter where they are in the world, and these are quality courses. At the same time, our partner universities are using these courses on their own campuses to offer a blended model of learning where they combine the online content and tools with in-person education, thereby creating a better experience for students on campus as well.
How is what you're doing, though, different from what any other MOOC provider is doing, MOOC being massive open online courses?
So edX is a leading MOOC provider. We have over 3 million learners from every single country in the world and about 400 courses in virtually every topic in multiple languages. So we're one of the leading providers. At the same time, we focus very heavily on quality and rigor. Our university partners try to offer courses that match the rigor of campus courses. But even more fundamentally, edX is a nonprofit. We are the only nonprofit MOOC provider out there. And we felt it's really important to be a nonprofit, particularly when we are creating technologies that can be extremely transformational to the education system. We've also made our platform open source. So we are the only open source MOOC platform out there, which means that anyone can take our platform and use it to help themselves.
You're nonprofit, but you've got to develop a revenue stream. Where are you on that at this point? How do you make money so that you're not just receiving injections from Harvard and MIT for years and years?
So, Harvard and MIT and many of our university partners have contributed to edX, thereby we haven't had to rely on venture capital money where they would rely or require a return on investment on their capital. So this way we can be completely mission focused. At the same time, we do have to be self-sustaining. And in order to be self-sustaining, we need a revenue stream. So we have a flexible set of approaches that we work with our partners in order for both our partners and for edX to be sustaining. Notice these courses are not free for our partners to produce. So one example is verified certificates. So a learner can take a course for free, but they can sign up to get a verified certificate for a small fee, like $50, for example. A second approach is that many countries have adopted open edX, such as China, India, France, the Middle East. And many of these countries come back to edX and they ask us if they can license courses from us. So we get a license fee when we're able to license courses to them.
But when you say verified certificates, who determines what those are worth in the open marketplace, that if you get a verified certificate from edX, what does that even mean for a college or university or a job that might want to hire you?
So, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And so ultimately, the marketplace will decide what the certificates are worth. And so today, many employers pay extreme attention to MOOC certificates. So, for example, there was a recent study by RTI that showed that 73% of the employers that they surveyed, they look for, you know, MOOC signups and MOOC activity on the resumes of their applicants. So they're certainly aware of MOOCs, and it takes a part in the decision making. Similarly, many universities pay attention to the MOOC courses the learners have taken when they apply to universities. So many of our learners post their verified certificate on edX on the LinkedIn profiles. And we have many examples of learners, you know, more than 100 that have obtained jobs in substantial measure because of the verified certificate that they obtained on a course from one of our universities on edX.
But you also have to deal with the same thing that every MOOC provider has to deal with, which is a lot of people don't complete these courses. In fact, the majority of people who do MOOCs don't end up finishing.
Again, this is you know, how you can play with statistics. So if you look at the total number of learners that simply click on an enroll button to explore a course, there, on average, I believe we have about 7% of our learners obtaining a certificate. However, if you take a cut across our learners and look at those learners that have indicated that they want to complete the course, so learners that have either signed up for an honor code certificate or signed up for a verified certificate, in that case, particularly for learners that have signed up for a verified certificate and put even a small amount of skin in the game, so to speak, with a small fee, there the pass rates go up to 60%. So certainly for learners that wish to complete, there is a substantial completion rate. And 60% is about the average university completion rate across schools in the United States.
We've been speaking with Anant Agarwal, the CEO of edX, about the rise of MOOCs in higher education. Millions of people around the globe have enrolled in these massive open online courses, and edX is working to drive that number far higher and to fundamentally change higher ed. And Anant, let me ask you about that. What do you think is so broken about the system that needs to be rethought?
Go to anybody in the world today and ask them if our education system is perfect and not broken. I think the person you ask would have to be delusional if they responded that our system is fine as is. Whether you look at the quality of education people are getting, I think we're lacking there. There are skills gaps as people graduate, and the problem is much worse in the developing world. If you look at the efficiency of education, that has been an issue as well, where in the U.S., student debt is at $1 trillion. And so while the education quality may be quite good, we're simply not able to deliver it with high quality. So I think whether it's cost, whether it's quality and scale, I think we have a lot to do to improve our education system.
You've got people at the institutions that are backing what you're doing who disagree with you. I'm sure that's no surprise to you, but I want to read some of their criticism here. This is from Peter Burgard, who teaches at Harvard, in an interview with The New Yorker, who says, "To me, college education in general is sitting in a classroom with students and preferably with few enough students that you can have a real interaction and really digging into and exploring a knotty topic, a difficult image, a fascinating text, whatever. That's what's exciting. There's a chemistry to it that simply cannot be replicated online." Then there is Woody Flowers, who's a professor at MIT. He says, "In edX's MOOCs, I believe we have a product without a strategy. We should design products that help us improve while also helping schools everywhere. MOOCs do neither." You've got traditional professors, basically, who are saying this new model of MOOCs, whether it's edX or anybody else, isn't as effective as learning in a classroom.
Clearly, you've very carefully selected the professors you've spoken to for some of the quotes. But really, I think when something is as transformative as this, you will get a lot of discussion and debate about how good this is and where it's helping. To the first point, absolutely. If I can get an education where there's three other students in a class and I have a professor, a great professor all to myself, you know, imagine if I could learn Chinese history from Peter Bowl from Harvard, and three of us have him all to ourselves. Well, what a phenomenal experience. But we all know that that is completely impractical. And so those that can afford it, sure, I think that is great. But the question is, how do we replicate this experience for not 20, not hundreds, but tens of thousands of students? And I think that is our challenge. In the second instance, I think if you talk to a lot of professors across many of our partner universities, they are using the content on campus. I think there's a strong strategy in place where we're working to increase access to education for students around the world. At the same time, today, two out of three MIT undergraduate students are using the edX platform on campus in various ways to improve the campus experience. And so any number of professors will talk about how they're using these courses on campus. As an example, Professor Michael Seema is teaching a solid-state chemistry course at MIT. He's blended the classroom by providing instant feedback through online exercises. Students find that fun and flexible.
So do you think that the better model then is just taking a MOOC all by itself or the blended model that you're talking about?
So that you can think of three ways of doing things. One is the purely in-person model. Second is the blended model. And third is the purely MOOC or the purely online model. And here, the degrees of introduction of technology increases. So I think the blended model is better, but the online experience can be as good as a in-person experience as well.
I want to ask you one more thing about something that you have talked about that goes even beyond what we're talking about with edX, which is you've talked about the unbundling of education.
If you look at how the world has progressed, if you look at AT&T from the late 70s, when I first came to this country in 1972, I had this pink AT&T phone and 411 would give me an AT&T operator. Bills came from AT&T. Everything came from AT&T. But today, the whole world of communications is unbundled. My cell phones come from somewhere. My long-distance plans come from somewhere else. AT&T is still a part of it, but it's unbundled. And the beauty of that is the whole field advanced dramatically. I've now gone from a rotund pink phone to every known shape and kind of phone. A dramatic improvement in technology, lowering of cost, huge improvements for consumers and the world. In education, we are still very stovepiped. Each institution in education today has to do everything: research, teaching, healthcare, housing, admissions, credentialing, marketing, the works. It is interesting to imagine what a world might look like where we think as universities, what are our key value adds? What's most important to us? Research, education. And imagine, could we do better if we were to focus on what's really, really important and somehow were to unbundle and enable others to do some of those pieces? And I talk about unbundling in time, function, and content. So let's take unbundling in content. Why should it be the case that a professor who teaches a course writes a textbook, teaches a course, writes the exams, the whole thing? Instead, a blended course is an unbundled course where you might use a MOOC from a professor from another university as a new age textbook. That would be unbundling of content. So we do some of that. Why can't we increase that? Today, why is it that every student has to learn in college when they are 18? Why 4 years? How about unbundling time? Imagine that a student comes into college having done their first year of courses as MOOCs and online, possibly even for free. And they come in and they get credit for those first year of courses. They spend 2 years on campus. And then rather than spending the fourth year on campus, they go outside, get a job, and become continuous learners for the rest of their lives. So a continuous education system like this could solve many problems. It would allow people to get just-in-time education on topics that are on the cutting edge of technology and learn as they need to learn. They might be better able to pay later.
But if you think about the reality of the situation, you've got parents who are just desperate that their kids are able to get jobs right out of school, and taking a risk like that and saying, I'm going to do this non-traditional approach, it's going to be difficult for that kind of thing to catch on because you know the value of a four-year degree at a university.
You know, the interesting, the prototypical type of student that goes to high school, and at the age of 18, fresh out of high school, goes into college and completes a college degree in 4 years. Of learners in the United States today, only 25% of learners fall into that category. 75% of people that want to learn are not high schoolers looking for a four-year college. A significant fraction are taking way more than 4 years. More than 60% of learners are dropping out of college with only 2 years of credit, and then they become continuing learners. A significant fraction of learners go to community college and collect units and credits, and then they transfer them into higher ed. So the non-traditional learner is more common by a ratio of 3-to-1 than the prototypical learner that we all, you know, have in our minds.
That's Anant Agarwal, the CEO of edX, and we've got more about edX at our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Jeremy. My pleasure to be here.
And as the NFL investigates whether the New England Patriots purposefully deflated footballs when they beat the Indianapolis Colts in the AFC Championship game, Patriots coach Bill Belichick tried to take some air out of the debate, at a press conference today.
When I came in Monday morning, I was shocked to learn of the news reports about the footballs. I had no knowledge whatsoever of this situation until Monday morning.
In fact, he said he's never, ever even talked to anyone about deflated balls, which, by the way, are easier to handle. I can't believe I'm reading this. And ESPN reports that 11 of the 12 balls the Patriots provided for the game, each team provides its own, were underinflated by 2 pounds. Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com and joins us. And Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but it didn't sound like Coach Belichick denied the balls were underinflated.
Yes, that's true.
Just he didn't know if they were, yeah.
Yeah, and we got an example of the white-hot scintillation that is a Bill Belichick press conference there. He did not deny it. He said, maybe you want to talk to Tom Brady, the quarterback, about that. Of course, the overheated and way overinflated sports media portrayed that as him tossing his quarterback under the bus. But in truth, you know, Belichick, although he is a control freak, and so people will say, that means he manages every blade of grass, that he barely touches a ball, and you can't prove. In fact, you could even say it's plausible that if his quarterback likes a ball a certain way, Bill Belichick wouldn't even know about that.
Well,
at least that's what Belichick said.
Well, Greg Doyle, writing in the Indianapolis Star, reminds us that Bill Belichick was the NFL accused him of being behind the last gate, which was Spygate, when they were busted for spying on opposing teams, that he was a part of that. So the opinion in Indianapolis is that Bill Belichick must have known. But here in Boston, longtime writer Dan Shaughnessy says the Patriots' legacy is done, already done, whether they did this or not. What are your thoughts?
I think that their legacy is about as damaged as George Washington's was for cherry tree demolition. Look, in hockey, if you have an overly curved stick, similar thing, an equipment, tweaking the equipment outside the rules, you get a 2-minute penalty. It's called a minor. It's the penalty in the NFL is not even as severe as that. It's $25,000, which winds up being 1/300th of Tom Brady's yearly salary if he wants to foot the bill. The clutching of overinflated pearls among the sports commentariat about this story is so stripped from reason, is so out of context. Not just Shaughnessy, not just Greg Doyle, who actually writes for CBS, and he writes things like, you're either a cheater or not. Okay, so everyone who committed a defensive holding penalty is in that cheater category. Jackie McMullen, who's a really great reporter, saying similar things. I'll tell you what's going on. It's a fun story. It is cheating. Can't say it's not. A little bit of gamesmanship, I like to think of it. Belichick is horrible to the press. He has never done anything to accommodate them. They're getting a little bit of revenge, I think, whether they know it or not.
Somebody tweeted out today, this is so adorable. The out-of-town reporters think they're going to get an answer from him. But just this afternoon, quarterback Tom Brady is going to hold his own press conference. They are getting, you know, Syrian refugees don't get this much coverage. But there are pieces about, you know, this $2.6 billion franchise, the Patriots, the number two in the league, 8 among sports franchises globally. Mm-hmm. I hear you saying none of this is endangered.
Oh, this is nothing. And, you know, you could also say the NFL, this $10 billion or $11 billion in yearly revenue. What kind of procedures do they have for, like, safeguarding their balls, their footballs, the most important piece of equipment? So there's a lot of doing things halfway. I think there'll be a reform saying that, you know, it will be league officials and not the teams who are responsible for ball inflation. I'll also say this. I think they should change the rule. If a quarterback likes a little bit of a mushier ball, so what? As long as both teams are allowed to have a ball call that's inflated to, you know, 10.5 PSI
from
instead
your
of 11
lips,
and a half?
From your no lips. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst and host of The Gist. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Today is the 42nd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that guarantees a woman's right to an abortion. Thousands of activists have gathered in Washington for an anti-Roe v. Wade demonstration. Meanwhile, House Republicans were planning to introduce a bill that would chip away at Roe v. Wade by banning abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, only allowing exceptions in cases of reported rape, incest, or the life of the mother. But some female Republicans balked. Rick Klein is the political director at ABC News in Washington, D.C. So, Rick, this bill is stalled off the table. What happened?
Remarkable scene. So House Republican leaders decided they were going to do this to coincide with the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. They like to pass anti-abortion legislation as part of that. But there was a rebellion inside their own caucus. You had Republican women primarily coming to leadership and saying, we don't like what you're saying here. You're saying that only if a woman goes to the police and reports a rape can she then be eligible for this exception under this abortion ban. That puts an undue burden on women. And you had Republican leaders faced with the prospect of losing the vote and an embarrassing defection among their females, their female members, and they decided to pull back and pull a still restrictive but more innocuous abortion curb bill instead.
Well, they were saying, as statistics show, most rapes are not reported to police. But talk about this other bill it was swapped out with.
It was swapped out with a bill that they essentially pass every 2 years, which would ban federal funding for abortions. And that may sound severe, but the fact is that most federal funding is already prohibited for abortions. This would go a little bit further and prohibit the District of Columbia from using even local funds for abortions. And that's why the president has issued a veto threat. The fact is, though, this is not the big sweeping bill that the Republicans had hoped to do to send a message as they took control to a social conservative base. Even though there wasn't a lot of campaign talk around these issues, it is still something that unites most conservative Republicans. It's something they still feel strongly about. And it's become kind of an annual or biannual, at least, tradition to pass bills like this to mark the date of Roe v. Wade.
Well, and why? The president said he would veto anything that restricted abortions. Abortion wasn't an issue in legislative elections last year. And also, abortions after the first 20 weeks are a very small portion. So why?
This is a window into what continues to animate and excite a portion, and it's probably not the majority of Republican activists, but a portion and particularly loud portion of activists. Issues like abortion, issues like gay marriage, issues very much around immigration are still very important, these social issues that took a back seat. It's mostly been Democrats talking about these issues in the past to try to highlight what they view as extreme Republican positions. But this is still enough of a priority that it ends up on the docket every 2 years, and what's remarkable here is Republicans had to pull back on their original plan.
And not do the one thing the women were asking for, change the rape victim language.
That's right. And I think they'll be back to the drawing board with that, knowing that they've got a lot of female members they have to make happy.
And just in a few seconds we have, was this shocking to the male Republicans?
It was. It's very rare that you have this kind of rebellion, and particularly one that is united around gender. And I don't think they were ready for this.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as the Republican Congress works to restrict abortion, Iowa's legislature has been going in the other direction. It's one of several states that has expanded abortion access in recent years. That's thanks to telemedicine, which connects doctors and patients remotely through video conferencing. But as Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden reports, the practice is being challenged in court.
Standing in an exam room, I'm waiting to meet with Dr. Jill Meadows. She's a Planned Parenthood physician. In Iowa, only doctors can perform abortions. I'm in Des Moines, but really, I could be at any of 9 Planned Parenthood clinics in Iowa because I'll be speaking with Dr. Meadows using a two-way video conference. She's in Iowa City, more than 100 miles away.
Good morning.
Hi. She just ran out to grab something. She'll be right back in.
After speaking with the patient and examining test results conducted by Planned Parenthood employees, Dr. Meadows can prescribe mifepristone, the medication that induces miscarriage. She does this by pressing a button in Iowa City that remotely opens a drawer in Des Moines that's stocked with the medication.
And I'll say it's going to pop out at 2, ready, set, go. It opens up. And I instruct her to take the pill bottle out on the left side first and swallow with the water there whenever she's ready with me watching, then we're done.
After taking the first pill in the office, patients take the second pill at home. Iowa's method of telemedabortion is unique in the United States. 16 other states banned the practice. Even the current Board of Medicine in Iowa ruled that abortion-inducing drugs could not be used in telemedicine. But Planned Parenthood challenged that ruling in district court. The court sided with the board, Planned Parenthood appealed, and the state Supreme Court will take the case up later this year. In the meantime, telemed abortions in Iowa continue. Iowa Board of Medicine Executive Director Mark Bowden says the board believes a doctor cannot determine if a patient is a suitable candidate for medical abortion using a video conference.
Further, the board is concerned that non-healthcare providers with little or no training were providing information to the doctor to make significant decisions on.
After examining telemed abortions, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists found the procedure safe and effective. A previous incarnation of the Board of Medicine reached the same conclusion. That board was appointed by Democratic Governor Chet Culver. The current board was appointed by Republican Governor Terry Branstad. And Planned Parenthood's attorney, Mike Folkstrom, says political ideology is now guiding the board's decision on telemed abortion.
It's always strange to me, like in our case here, where you have the board very concerned about regulating what is one of the safest procedures in American medicine in this very tight way, when they have not banned telemedicine in any other context.
In 2013, a petition of 20,000 signatures was filed with the board by Iowa Right to Life. An open records request by the Des Moines Register revealed an email sent to a lawyer in the governor's office from Jenny Condon, the executive director of an anti-abortion crisis pregnancy center. Folkstrom says the email suggests coordination between the Branstad administration and anti-abortion activists.
It was very much this, let's all get together, you know, let's make sure we're on the same page about how to make this happen and how to make the petition look right and how to make the signatures look right.
Board of Medicine Executive Director Bowden declined to talk about the email, but the board's lawyers say since the email was addressed to the governor's office and not the board, there's no proof board members coordinated with anti-abortion groups to end telemed abortion. Iowa Republican State Senator David Johnson is also trying to stop telemed abortion in the state. He just filed a bill stipulating that abortions can only be induced in a clinic or hospital with facilities to intervene surgically in cases of incomplete abortion or severe bleeding. But Democrats control the state Senate, so the measure is unlikely to pass, leaving the future of telemed abortion in Iowa in the hands of the state Supreme Court. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Bowden in Des Moines.
Time now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
Bo Leibowitz is a jazz DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He is with us now. Bo, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you wanted us to hear some interesting new jazz releases, and let's get right to them. This is from John Coltrane. This is called My Favorite Things. Now, this is somebody that many people know, John Coltrane, but this is a new release, right?
Well, yes, it's sort of new. Two tracks from this were issued on a very low-quality bootleg many years ago, but this is a live performance from Temple University from 1966, about 9 months before Coltrane died. And what they did is they went to the local radio station, the Temple radio station, WRTI, and they found the master tapes. So it's being released for the first time, and it's a very important document because not only is it one of Train's last recordings, but he, of course, was the spiritual and musical leader of the avant-garde, and we would all wait for the next Coltrane record in the same way that other people would wait for the next Beatles record or Dylan record.
Well, what do you like about this one musically?
Well, first of all, it's Coltrane, and just about everything he played is worth listening to. But he is playing here My Favorite Things, which is one of his most popular recordings from back in the 60s. And it's he's on soprano saxophone here, an instrument that he sort of resurrected from the past, which had lain dormant since the days of Sidney Bechet, pretty much.
It almost sounds like a clarinet.
Yes, it wasn't played too often because it's very hard to keep in tune, that particular instrument. Mm. But now we have just about all tenor saxophonists also play soprano because it gives them more gigs, more big band opportunities, for one. But the music is very avant-garde. It's very outside. Coltrane at one point even puts down the horn and starts singing and beating his chest almost as if there was nothing left to play on the horn. So he was looking for another outlet of expression.
Well, let's get to another one that you wanted us to hear. This is the Chick Corea Trio, and the piece is Recordame. This song is a jazz standard written by Joe Henderson. Let's listen to this new Chick Corea version. Listeners may be familiar with pianist Chick Corea. He was in the Miles Davis Band in the 60s. He won 20 Grammys. What do you hear in this new album and this piece?
Christian McBride is the bass player, and he is, in my opinion and the opinion of a lot of people, the greatest bass player on the planet. And this trio has a sort of independence, I might add that Brian Blade is the drummer, that harkens back to the flowering of the piano trio, which sort of began with Bill Evans, where the bass was liberated and didn't have to just keep time, but could become an independent voice and interact. Takes a lot of listening, and these guys are masters at it.
Well, let's turn to some lesser-known artists. This is the jazz cellist Akua Dixon, and this is her take on the Duke Ellington piece Freedom. Gosh, all those years when I was growing up playing the cello, I could have been a jazz cellist. That was what I should have gone for.
You would have been one of very few. There aren't very many, which is one of the things that interested me about this particular recording. This is her second record as a leader, but she has been around since the 70s.
And this is an interesting version of Freedom.
Yes, this is a Duke Ellington piece that was part of his sacred concerts. And what Ms. Dixon has done is she has inserted a middle section, which sounds rather classical, not surprising since she has a classical background. And then it goes back to the Ellington part. So the Ellington piece sort of bookends her original middle phase.
Bo Leibowitz, you also wanted us to know about jazz singer Melissa Stiglianu. Here is her take on the jazz standard I Wish I Knew, No Regrets. It's written by Harry Warren.
I wish I knew someone like you could love me. I wish I knew you'd place no one above me. Did I mistake this for a real romance? I wish I knew, but only you can answer. If you don't care, why let me hope and pray so? Don't lead me on.
Beautiful, delicate voice there. Tell us about Melissa Stiglianu.
Well, you hit it right on the head. It's very delicate, but it's effortless, and she swings quite nicely. And it's just a great tune. I wish I knew from Harry Warren and Mack Gordon, two of the greatest composers of pop music from the 30s all the way up. They did a lot of movie musicals. All the Busby Berkeley scores were from Harry Warren.
Well, we have time for one more. This is jazz trumpeter Carl Saunders and his take on The Flight of the Bumblebee. Here is Bumblebee Blues. Now, when I hear that, I think the bumblebee is a little happier, a little more chilled out. He's
absolutely
taking his time.
He might have even been on something. Who knows?
Tell us about Carl Saunders.
Well, he's a trumpet player from here in Los Angeles with a beautiful tone. This is his new disc, America. And I chose that track just because everybody is familiar with the Rimsky-Korsakov piece. And it is sort of something that fledgling trumpet players probably have to play in the concert field anyway. And they usually play it much faster. But as you can see, he's turned it into a very relaxed blues.
Bo Leibowitz, a jazz DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Bo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That is on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also see them at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.